ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National. A show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Hi, I'm Belinda Smith, and this week on The Science Show, feet. That's right, feet. Big feet, little feet, extinct feet. We are all about the Tootsies. First up, an animal with a stompy reputation but that's surprisingly light on its feet, the elephant. Living alongside them has its challenges, not least their appetite for crops that you might be growing. We begin this story in the heart of southern Africa, where farmers and scientists are trialling unconventional deterrents against free-ranging, crop-raiding elephants.
The only signs that you would know that elephants have been in these areas is dung, and there's a lot of elephant poo.
Dr. Tempe Adams lives in rural Botswana, and elephants visit in the night.
You wake up in the morning and you can see that they've been through, and obviously their tracks. And maybe you can see some browsing damage done when they've been eating some trees. They come in very quietly.
Botswana's home to about 2.5 million people. How many elephants are there?
Hotly debated, but officially, scientifically speaking, there's estimated to be around 130,000 elephants in Botswana at the moment. Obviously, that fluctuates based on seasonality, because what's amazing about Botswana's elephants is they're also Zimbabwe's elephants, they're also Namibia's elephants, all our neighbouring countries, so we don't have fenced boundaries largely throughout the country, so elephants can freely move in and out of the country.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Elephants don't respect the lines that we draw on maps. So where do they tend to cross paths with people?
So we have urban towns, and then we have a lot of farming areas that sit right alongside wildlife protected areas. And a lot of the elephant range is outside of the protected areas as well, because as I said, they're free ranging, big moving animals, so they need a lot of space. So elephants, it's not uncommon on a daily basis walking through our farming areas here.
Wherever you find animals living around people or people pushing into their habitat, usually don't have to look too far to find friction between the humans and their surrounding species. So what are some of the conflicts between people and elephants in Botswana?
Yeah, I mean, it can take so many different forms. I mean, the whole definition of conflict is a negative interaction. We love to use the word interaction now as science. It can be you're walking to work and you might see an elephant off in the distance. And, you know, you're literally walking in a space where elephants walk. It could be that you're on a bus going off to soccer practice and there's an elephant on the side of the road and you have to sort of navigate how do you get your vehicle past that animal. It can be you are a crop farmer and you've got your maize crop ripening beautifully in the field and an elephant might come by your crop that night and you have to scare it away, or maybe you're too scared to scare it away, and trying to navigate those situations. So interactions with elephants that have sort of a negative consequence or negative feeling, whether it makes you feel unsafe or it's literally damage from them, caused by them eating their crops. What I've always been fascinated by is why are these elephants moving through these different areas? Is it to crop raid? Is it to come and eat these crops? Or is it to move through pathways that they were always used to move through and suddenly we're developing over them? That's a different kind of conflict. That's a different cause of the conflict. Is it to access water and resources? And what we've actually found in Botswana is one of the lead causes of these people and elephants coming into closer contact with each other, because Botswana is very dry, is about water and access to water. And not surprisingly, a lot of our farming is along these permanent waterways or semi-permanent waterways, and those are the exact areas that elephants need to access to drink water to survive.
Ah, yes, water. This is the source of many conflicts, interactions, between humans and animals, not just in Africa, but around the world.
So yes, there is opportunistic crop raiding when they smell ripening crops. It's very hard to resist not going in and eating them. But a lot of it is actually just people and elephants coming into contact around water resources, whether it's floodplains or artificial water holes. So our conflict is driven largely by water.
When an elephant does walk through a crop, whether to get to the river that's on the other side or to eat whatever delicious food is in the paddock, I don't imagine they tiptoe in and then delicately make their way out again. What kind of damage can an elephant do just making its way through a crop?
Well, that's what's really interesting. Actually, every elephant's different. Sometimes you will have very polite elephants that literally step over the fences.
Oh, how very nice.
And step over, out of the fences. There's some great videos online, actually, just if you Google elephants stepping over fences, it's quite, or climbing under fences even. It's quite amazing, actually, for such a big animal. They can definitely climb under fences sometimes. But I think it depends on the elephant itself. But that does vary from country to country even, actually, or district to district. I mean, an elephant can, depending on the size of the crop, could eat the whole crop in the night. And when you're a subsistence farmer, that's huge. It literally presents a very, very big issue. No pun intended.
Now, you mentioned fencing before. What sort of measures have people traditionally used to try to keep elephants out?
The traditional form of fencing is made from the acacia branches. So they've got these big, big spines and thorns on them. Farmers will often light a fire. So most farmers, if they can, they'll have someone stay by the field when the crops are growing, whether they're in a tent or they've built themselves a little hut. Some have a little actual house structure on the crop fields. So having that human presence there is really important. And then they will bang drums when they can hear something coming. Not literally a drum. More often than not, people have an old barrel, you know, a fuel barrel, and bang a barrel. So make whatever noise they can, even hand clapping. They'll shine torches or we'll have that fire going. So then we'll wave a fire branch around. Anything to let that animal know, I see you, get out of my field.
And that means scientists have to use ingenuity as well. There's a whole range of things people have tried to keep elephants away from crops.
The whole science of elephant deterrence has blown up in the last 20 years.
And that is largely due to this woman.
I had quite an unusual upbringing.
Dr. Lucy King.
My parents were both teachers and we were brought up in Somalia, Lesotho and then Kenya.
Her childhood experiences on safari shaped her ideas.
And I was just blown away, not only by the wild animals and the experience of living and camping in the bush, but particularly by this juxtaposition of seeing these beautiful wild animals coming hard up against fences.
Such as electric fences. And you might think, well, a little zap's not going to stop an elephant. But these fences can have 16 strands of wire with 8,000 volts of electricity running through them.
I mean, they really do shock an elephant if they touch it. But I really felt quite passionate as a teenager growing up that animals, particularly elephants, should be able to roam freely. So this wild animal interest, but also how they clash with humans, has been something that's been part of my world for a long time.
Lucy went off to uni to study zoology, then returned to Kenya to look into cheaper, better, and more natural alternatives to electric fences to stop or at least put off elephants from raiding crops. And her very first idea came from local folklore.
We discovered that the rural livestock farmers who were out in the bush knew that elephants wouldn't attack or forage on or push over trees in the savannah which had wild beehives in. And we heard this folklore and were absolutely intrigued by this and just went, is it possible that a tiny bee can keep an elephant from pushing a tree down to feed on the branches? Could we prove that this folklore was real? So we came up with a whole load of experimental ideas to test whether elephants were scared of bees. And can you imagine how difficult this is? You've got a wild African honeybee, which could literally kill you if you mess around with it.
This is no exaggeration. African honeybees are aggressive. And when they attack as an army. They've killed hundreds of people.
So it was a really difficult experiment and both of these species could kill me.
In the end, to show that elephants are indeed scared of African bees.
Where we came up with the idea of recording the sound of the bees and playing that back to elephants as a much quicker and obviously safer way of testing the hypothesis.
How do you play a recording of a bee to an elephant?
Well, scratched our heads for a long time about this. Eventually, we came up with this idea that I threw a bee suit on, went out and found a beehive, and we set up a whole load of microphones around a wild African beehive, and we threw a stone into the hive. And, you know, that doesn't sound great, but we didn't kill any bees, but it did disturb the colony dramatically. And I got this incredible eruption of very angry African honeybees that swarmed out of the hive into the microphone.
This is that original recording of Angry Bees. Then Lucy would find a family of elephants snoozing under a tree and surreptitiously place speakers around them. Then she'd hit play on that angry bee recording or a control sound, which in this case was a waterfall. It sounds a lot like white noise. Then she watched what the elephants did.
And the results were very dramatic, highly significant, that they would not only run away from the bee sounds and not the control sounds, they would shake their heads, but they would also dust themselves.
This shaking and dusting is to shoo away any bees that might be buzzing around.
It turned out they were also rumbling to each other in infrasound as they ran away. They were actually rumbling with a very specific rumble that was literally, run away, there are bees here.
These rumbles are too low for us to hear, but elephants use them to communicate over huge distances.
And this sound was passing through the bush to other elephants who were hearing like a panic rumble from their friends.
Why does a tiny bee get such a huge reaction from an elephant?
What's extraordinary about this is they're tiny compared to an elephant. You cannot imagine that they could sting through an elephant's skin. I mean, elephant skin is 2 centimetres thick. It's completely absurd to suggest that a bee can sting. But it turns out that these bees, they focus on the watery areas. So those are the most sensitive membranes of the elephants, particularly the eyes, which of course very thin membrane around there, and in the inside of the trunk, which is not only a thin, soft skin layer inside, but it's wet. So the bees are attracted to that kind of moisture. Behind the ears of an elephant is actually very, very thin skin. It's the only place where the blood vessels on an elephant reach the air. So that's why an elephant flaps its ears all the time, because the blood running through the back of the ears is being cooled by the thin skin there. So the bees go for these thin areas, particularly the watery areas. And if a bee stings around the eye or around the trunk, it releases a pheromone, and it's that pheromone that puffs into the air, and all the other bees are attracted to that pheromone, and then they can sting the same place. So it really is not one bee sting. It's actually the elephant has probably learnt that if one bee stings, the rest are going to plunge onto the same site and start stinging multiple times. And that, of course, would be very painful and quite scary as well, having bees zooming around your face, buzzing very loudly. So we think that's what's going on. And it's really the threat of many bee stings, not just one, that's scaring them.
Lucy wondered how she could take advantage of that fear of bees to protect crops. What if you could make a fence that wasn't electrified, but beeified? Her first design for a beehive fence was scribbled on a notepad, and it was a series of beehives strung along a wire surrounding a paddock.
So that if an elephant tries to walk into the farm, it's going to hit the wire or the rope or whatever you connect the hives with, and it'll cause the hives to swing, release the bees, and that's your auto trigger to scare the elephants away.
And it worked really well. Elephants would walk into the fence, rattle the hives, the bees would fly out, and the elephant would hot-foot it out of there.
That beehive fence design was part of my PhD, and we went out and tested it. It was highly successful, and we've improved the design over time, but that very first design that I scribbled down on the back of a notepad is actually the original.
Meanwhile, Dr. Tempe Adams is in Botswana, thousands of kilometres away from Lucy in Kenya, and in a completely different environment, but of course, there are plenty of elephants. Could bee fences work in Botswana too?
So I was fascinated by this whole bee idea. So before going in and building up beehive fences and putting them up around crop fields, I just literally said, okay, let's just play the sound of African honeybee to resting, sleeping elephants, because it's a relatively low-cost experiment to go and do.
And what did you find?
It was fascinating, absolutely fascinating, because we got a mixed reaction, which was amazing.
Yeah, mixed is right. While the Kenyan elephants had a pretty consistent, oh shit, reaction to the sound of bees, not all the Botswanan elephants reacted the same way. Don't get me wrong, some did get up and run, but others just weren't fussed in the slightest.
So basically what it says is elephants do react to the sound of bees in Botswana, but they don't all react the same way. And it begs the question, and it's an obvious question, it's like, why would we maybe get this response, a mixed response? And it's quite simple and quite obvious. Well, let's look at, are these elephants coming into contact with bees often?
And this is where the difference in environment comes in. Kenya's tropical. It straddles the equator. So on the whole, it's much wetter than Botswana. And bees need water. Less water, fewer bees. Fewer bees, less chance of getting stung.
So the conclusions that we drew was that these elephants, the ones that have probably been in contact with bees before and had a negative interaction with them, then have learnt to be scared of the sound of bees. But if they haven't come across bees and they haven't had a negative interaction with them, then they don't know to be scared of them, so they won't react. We don't have many flowering plants, so we don't really have a very healthy bee population. We don't have as many bees as other countries that have consistent flowering plants available. And then I managed to dig a little deeper to actually look at the beekeeping industry in Botswana. And basically, there isn't much. And there has been a lot of initiatives to try and get beekeeping going. But they've really struggled to get bees to stay. So you might get a colony come and establish itself, but it might only be there for one season and then they go and then they don't come back. So it's a lot more about bees than elephants, actually, and better understanding the beekeeping and bee world here than the elephant world, interestingly.
Who would have thought studying the world's biggest land animals would turn into a crash course in the ecology of honeybees? But Botswana's bee-unfriendly climate might be a taste of what's to come for lusher, greener Kenya.
What we found in Kenya, we're having more and more droughts these days because of climate change. And so if you have an extreme drought for 2 years, your bees are going to basically start to suffer so badly and disappear. They're not going to breed. And a lot of our hives will just go quiet in a drought. So we might only have 10 or 15% occupation of our hives.
More empty hives mean the bee fences are, naturally, less effective. But bees aren't the only way to keep elephants away from crops. Lucy, Tempe and others all across Africa are trialling things like asking farmers to grow crops that elephants don't find particularly tasty, or use other deterrents like a super stinky concoction made with manure and chili and other smelly ingredients. There's dozens of different methods which farmers can mix and match depending on what works for them. And Tempe, in Botswana, continues to talk to local farmers to test more elephant-discouraging ideas.
Interestingly, I've just recently had a farmer say to me she plays her radio all night and she is convinced that that keeps elephants out of her crop field. So she'll play it all through the night and then she switches it off. So maybe it's letting elephants know there's people active there chatting away. Maybe that's working. But having said that, I have had another farmer in that same area say they had the radio on in their field and I was like, oh, and how does it go? And they said the elephant came, picked up the radio and threw it against a tree. Yeah.
Well, it clearly didn't like whatever was on the station. Like, it was like, oh, why did you tune it to this one and not that one? I want Radio National.
Exactly.
Dr. Tempe Adams, an elephant biologist with the University of New South Wales. We also heard from Dr. Lucy King, coexistence director with Save the Elephants. Last week on The Science Show, I reported on a mystery species of human that lived in an Indonesian cave for tens of thousands of years. Fossilised remains from that mystery human species could help archaeologists figure out exactly who they were. But even finding a whole skeleton doesn't necessarily mean everyone will agree on its identity. One such skeleton, originally classified as an ancient hominin called Australopithecus prometheus, maybe a whole new species altogether. Dr. Jesse Martin from the University of Cambridge and La Trobe University led a study into the skeleton, which is nicknamed Littlefoot.
The first part of it that was discovered was a tiny little bit of foot bone, thus the name Littlefoot, but it wasn't found deep down in the dark and damp caves. It was found in a box of other fossils thought to belong to animals that aren't humans by a man called Dr. Ron Clark.
He could see that the foot bone, and a few others he also found, did not belong to a baboon, as was originally thought, but belonged to some kind of early hominin, some kind of Australopithecus species. And Australopithecus is ancient. It lived in Africa from around 4 million to 2 million years ago. While searching through the museum's boxes and bags of bones, Ron and his colleagues also came across a snapped-off piece of shin bone. It and all the foot and ankle bones came from a site in South Africa called the Sterkfontein Caves, and Ron thought the shin fragment in particular could help them find the rest of the skeleton. Here's Jesse Martin again.
And what they then did was they took this bone and they walked the entirety of the length of the Sterkfontein Caves, which are these really massive, deep, complex and dark cave systems where you have to shimmy along on your side and get down on your hands and knees. And they took this bone and they lined it up with all the other bits of little bone that they could see sticking out of the wall until they found where it fit. And once they found where it fit, they started digging into the cave wall. And over the period of decades, they excavated what turned out to be the entire skull. And so it's an absolutely one in a thousand type story of discovery.
Yeah, so when the Littlefoot skeleton was unveiled, it was identified as an ancient hominin called Australopithecus prometheus. Others since have thought it might be another Australopithecus called Australopithecus africanus. You think it's something else altogether, but before we get to why that is, what do we know about the individual from that beautiful, almost complete skeleton?
Well, we're only just scratching the surface. It was first published, Littlefoot, in 2019, and then, of course, we had COVID. So it was very difficult for researchers to travel to be able to look at this fossil. And so I think we're a little bit behind, but catching up now. We know that Littlefoot walked on two legs. We know that it must have had pretty powerfully built chewing muscles. We know that it's an adult because it has its adult teeth. But aside from that, what it was eating, how it was living, all of that work, all of that knowledge is still to play for. And I think that our hope is to play a very small part in trying to work out what species Littlefoot represents.
Okay, so key to Littlefoot's identity is not its feet, but its skull. So let's take a look at the skull in question. We have a few 3D printed crania in front of us on these tables, in various states by the looks of them. Some are a bit more complete than others. Which one is Littlefoot's head?
This one is Littlefoot.
This is Luca Morris Obst, a master's student at La Trobe University.
I always think he looks really funny because it kind of looks like he's got a permanent blue steel look on his face.
So the skull is also complete, but it looks like it's been squashed a bit. What's caused that squishing?
So that would happen from just sediment buildup over years, everything coming down and compacting on it. It's in a cave site. Everything's falling on top of it and essentially like solidifying and squishing. And as we said, it's in a limestone cave, so everything's calcifying. So when this one was taken out, it's actually like in one big chunk. You would not be able to remove the mandible from the jaw from the rest of the crania because it's all just smushed together.
Right. Okay. So you can't pry open its jaw and take a look inside its mouth. Yeah. Okay, so what is it about Littlefoot's slightly squished skull, which means that you don't think it belongs to the species Australopithecus prometheus?
So obviously when we did our analysis, we had to look at the type specimen, which is the first fossil ever found for Australopithecus prometheus, and that only preserves a tiny portion of the back of the crania. So when we're doing our comparison, despite having an almost complete skeleton, for Littlefoot, we could only compare it to the back of that bit, which obviously proves a lot of problems in itself. But even in that tiny area, there were still a lot of differences that we could notice.
The first is that Littlefoot has a thing we call sagittal crest. So if you put your hands on the side of your temple and you open and close your jaw, you'll feel the muscle move. That's the temporalis muscle. And ours are right on the side of our head. If you've got a cat or a dog as a pet and you scratch their head, you feel a big ridge of bone. That's called a sagittal crest, and that's because their chewing muscles are so big they go right to the top of the head. Littlefoot was like cats or dogs in that way. It had these massive chewing muscles, whereas Prometheus, on average, doesn't. So that's one of the ways in which they're quite different. The others are in relation to the ways in which the different bones of the cranium join together in an area on the side and back of your head we call a sternum, which is very unique and very primitive, actually, in Littlefoot, and also in terms of the length of the bottom and back of the skull. Littlefoot has this massively long, what we call nuchal plane, which is essentially the bottom and back of the skull.
Right, so you can tell this despite Littlefoot's skull being squished over the many, many, many years it was locked away in a cave, you could still distinguish those differences between this slightly warped skull and the fragment of skull that we have from Australopithecus prometheus, which I believe is called MLD1.
Well, we're actually pretty lucky because despite Littlefoot being pretty distorted, the back of the crania where we would compare it to MLD1 is actually pretty well preserved and undistorted.
Oh, that's very convenient. Nice one, Littlefoot. Thanks for that. So how do you know these are species-specific differences and not just, oh, this individual's got a slightly bigger head than this one, or this individual has a slightly more strangely shaped head than this one?
There are, of course, size differences. You know, if you look around at different modern humans, we're different sizes. And to some extent, slightly different shapes. But these are areas of anatomy, particularly in the base of the skull, that don't change very much or very quickly during human evolution. Our teeth change, anything to do with the way we interact with the environment changes quite quickly because it's about getting food in your body. But the back of your skull, that's just about holding your head up straight. And we've been doing that for 6.5 million years. So that's actually an area of anatomy where when you do see changes, it's quite significant. And it generally speaks to a species or greater level divergence.
Now, there's been a bit of controversy around when Littlefoot walked the earth. Can you just walk me through that debate?
So what we have in terms of the ages for Sterkfontein broadly are two hypotheses. One is that it's 2.6 million years old. That's based on a method called uranium lead dating, electron spin resonance dating, and paleomagnetic dating, and also faunal analysis. And then we have an older age of about 3.2 million years, which is based on a method called cosmogenics. So it's just interesting, I think, to note that this isn't about scientists interpreting the same data differently. This is about different dating methods giving different signals. And that's because caves are incredibly complex places. Sediment gets eroded and reworked and redeposited. And so I would say that whatever else be true about the age of Littlefoot, it is the same age as everything else from Sterkfontein, whether that's 2.6 or 3.2 million.
Either way, it's still really old. So why are people so worried as to whether it's 2.6 million years old or 3.2 million years old?
I think the easiest way to understand it is if you imagine reconstructing your own family tree, it's about whether or not the person you're interested in is your great-grandmother or your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. 2.6 million years is a really important time in human evolution because we know from other parts of Africa, in particular East Africa, and only through little scraps of teeth and bone, that our direct ancestors in the form of Homo are appearing on the landscape for the very first time. So if Littlefoot is 2.6 million years old, it's definitely in the right time zone, either to be one of our direct ancestors in the sense that it's ancestral to Homo, or minimally living alongside our direct ancestors. If it's older than that, at 3.5 million years old, then it would represent a very, very early occurrence of a quite modern type of human.
So you think that it might be a completely different species to any that are currently known, which would make Littlefoot its own little branch on the human ancestors' family tree, I suppose?
I think that's the key implication of our study. We haven't yet done the work to determine exactly what Littlefoot is. Really, what we've done is find two things that it isn't. And our work shows, I think, pretty conclusively that Littlefoot definitely isn't Prometheus. And to the extent that most people think Prometheus and Africanus are actually the same thing, it is by implication also not Africanus. That's really what's got us interested. It's so rare to find these fossils. It's rarer still to find one as complete as Littlefoot. And then it's infinitesimally rare to find both of those things of a previously unknown and new type of human. So the next steps for us will be to try and work out what Littlefoot is, where it sits and fits in the human family tree, and how it relates ultimately to us and our emergence onto the landscape. If Littlefoot represents a new species, then one of the really interesting implications is that more than one type of human are sharing the Sterkfontein cave landscape at the same time. And that raises all sorts of, I think, fascinating questions. What might those interactions have been like? Might they have stared across the hill at one another and kept their distance? Might they have fought? Might they have been friends or at least ambivalent to one another? We don't know. And in some ways, it's really hard to tell, but I think it's unique to consider that we are now, as the only surviving and last human, we are the aberration. We are the outlier. All other times, it seems, almost, in our human evolutionary history, we were sharing the landscape with other types of humans.
Dr. Jesse Martin, an archaeologist at the University of Cambridge and La Trobe University in Melbourne, and his master's student, Luca Morris-Obst. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. Fossilised foot bones can give us a glimpse into the life of other extinct species too, such as giant kangaroos. Some scientists have calculated that the giant roos were simply too big to hop, but new research suggests they could, if only for a very short time. I spoke to Megan Jones, who did a study as part of her PhD at the University of Manchester and University of Melbourne, and we started by talking about when Australia's giant kangaroos went extinct.
Giant kangaroos are shockingly recent in many ways. They are around in what's called the Pleistocene, so around the Ice Age, although obviously it wasn't particularly icy in Australia at the time. So they were around at the same time as humans first started showing up in Australia. Around 40 to 50,000 years ago is when they really went extinct. There was a general extinction of a lot of the Australian megafauna around that time, and they were part of that.
How big were these extinct kangaroos compared to, say, the red kangaroos that we have today?
So red kangaroos are the largest that we have around today. The largest that they get to is around 90 kilograms. And that's just the really big males. Most of them are much more around like 40, 50. Whereas the giant kangaroos, we have quite a few species that are getting up to around 160, 180 kilograms. And then the absolute largest that we have is this species called Procoptodon goliah, which reaches 250 kilograms.
A quarter of a ton. It's just wild to think of a kangaroo weighing that much. So they were quite hefty. Do you know how tall they were?
Surprisingly short when you when you quote that. They're things like 2 meters. So they are taller. They are taller than today's red kangaroos, but not by an awful lot. A lot of it is just bulk. They're very solid kangaroos.
They're hench kangaroos. Gotcha.
Yes.
As far as Australian animals go, kangaroos are iconic. They bound across the landscape. And with the exception of tree kangaroos, they all hop. You've got your wallabies and your wallaroos. They're all in the same family. So what is it about present day kangaroos which makes them such good hoppers?
A lot of it is obviously in the hind limbs. They have these really exaggerated, really large hind limbs in proportion to their forelimbs. And they also have, when you get to the larger ones today, the Achilles tendon is able to be stretched a lot during hopping and acts almost like an elastic band, where it kind of stores this energy so that it releases it into the next hop, which means that they can be very efficient. They don't really need to put as much work in the muscles into the next hop because they have this elastic band of a tendon that's giving them a lot of that on the recoil. And yeah, obviously kangaroos today vary a lot in their ability. Even the tree kangaroos, which you mentioned, they do hop. You just don't see them do it a lot. But they're capable.
There's been some debate about whether their extinct giant counterparts were simply too big to hop. What are some of the theories for how they got around, and what evidence has backed up those ideas?
When it comes to thinking about the locomotion of the extinct species, you really have to be thinking about both the slow locomotion and fast locomotion. Because if you think about kangaroos today, sure, they can hop across a plain really fast, but a lot of the time they're just kind of shuffling around. The large ones today doing something called pentapedal locomotion, where they're walking with their tails as well as like a fifth leg. So there are three main groups of extinct kangaroos that get up to these giant sizes. The first ones of them are what's called the giant macropus species. They are very closely related to today's big kangaroos. They're kind of the next group over from a red kangaroo, but bigger. And there's not been a huge amount done on their locomotion. It's kind of assumed they're moving similar ways, but may or may not have been able to hop. Then we have Pteranodon, which is the next most distantly related group to today's big kangaroos. They have quite long forelimbs. And it's been suggested that they spend a lot of time quadrupedal, just walking on all fours, basically.
Like a dog?
Or it might be more of like a slightly bounding motion, a little bit more like a rabbit, I guess, but slow. And then we have the Stenyrenes, and this is the most distantly related group from today's kangaroos by quite a way. They're called the short-faced kangaroos because they have very short faces with very boxy skulls. And there's been some quite good evidence based on looking at the hind limbs of the Stenyrenes. They might have walked bipedally, almost like a T-Rex. And a lot of that is just looking at the structure of their feet and that sort of thing. But then there's the question of, could they hop? Can they do this fast gait that all of the kangaroos today do? And the idea that they can't is based on a couple of studies which have taken today's big kangaroos and scaled them up to the size of these giant kangaroos and said, okay, at what point do we start running into problems? And the problem that they find is that Achilles tendon that I mentioned earlier, that whilst it's very, very useful to have it bending so much, you can get all of this elastic energy in it. If you think about an elastic band, if you pull it too much, it's going to break. And as you get heavier, you're pulling it more. And therefore, they were extrapolating onto these giant sizes. And a couple of studies have landed on a value of around 140 to 160 kilograms. that they think at that point they would start breaking those tendons if they tried to hop.
Right. So the quarter-ton Procoptodon Goliath would have to walk because its Achilles tendon simply wouldn't be strong enough to support their heft, which is over 160 kilograms.
Yeah, so that's the proposed limit, and that's what this study has been trying to reevaluate.
And how did you reevaluate that?
So like I said, these previous studies are based on the idea that you take today's kangaroos and you scale them up. But these giant kangaroos aren't just today's kangaroos scaled up. They have quite different proportions. So some of the authors of these previous studies have mentioned this. They've said, if you take into account these different proportions, the different shapes of the bones in these giant species, you might find something different. So we wanted to go and do the calculations on that and see if we did find a different result. And what we found was that the heel bones, where the Achilles tendon is anchored, they get shorter and they get broader proportionally in these giant species, which means that they can have this thicker tendon. And again, if we go back to the analogy of a elastic band, if you have an elastic band and you make it thicker, it's going to be harder to pull, but it's also not going to break anywhere near as easily. So once we take into account the fact that they might have had these thicker tendons, we actually find that it's not physically impossible for them to hop anymore.
So you looked at actual giant kangaroo fossils to do this study. How many fossils did you look at?
In total, we have 40 different fossil specimens in this study. Not all of those are giant. There are a few of those that are smaller relatives that are also extinct, but most of them are.
So with the giant kangaroo species, you found that their heel bone, where the Achilles tendon attaches, is nice and broad, which means it could have a thicker, stronger Achilles tendon. And this could allow the biggest of the extinct kangaroos, like Procoptodon Goliath, to potentially hop, even though they may not use that as their primary way of getting around.
Yes, exactly.
So why does it matter if we know if they were capable of hopping or not, apart from picturing what a megafauna-laden landscape might have looked like 50,000 years ago?
It does very much shape our picture of what the ecosystem at the time was like. So if you think about how an animal moves, that affects how it's going to be interacting with the other animals in its environment. In particular, it's going to affect, in this case, predation. So if an animal can hop, it can use that burst of speed to get away from predators a lot more effectively. And at this time, you have a species called Thylacoleo, which is the marsupial lion, which is a wonderful species. They have the strangest, very blade-like teeth and massive thumb claws. And there is some pretty good evidence that they did predate on some of these giant kangaroos. So the idea of whether they can hop or not really affects how we think about the defense mechanisms that these species might have used. And also, if we did, I know much less about this side of it, but if you did have human predation on this species, which I don't see why you wouldn't, again, that will affect how able these species were to get away from that situation.
Right. So giant kangaroos might have been able to put on a short, sharp burst of hopping speed as a way to escape being hunted. That's a nice little potential behavioural insight from their fossilised foot bones. What are you working on now? Still on the giant kangaroos?
So I'm carrying on with the rest of the PhD. I'm doing giant kangaroos still, but on their spinal columns, because all of the work that's been done to date on their locomotion is very focused on the hind limbs, which makes sense. Obviously, the hind limbs are very important, but the spinal column has kind of been neglected a bit, and particularly when you have the pentapedal mode of locomotion that I talked about earlier, where they use, today's kangaroos use their tail as like a fifth limb. So I want to look at the tail of these giant species, see could they do that? What else could they do? Could they do reaching in certain directions? All of that sort of stuff.
Megan Jones, a PhD student at the University of Manchester and University of Melbourne. Jumping now from big hoppers in Australia to small ones, feral rabbits. This story idea came from a listener, Marge, who's noticed more bunnies than usual around her suburban Sydney home. She wanted to know, why haven't we developed a new virus to manage the booming rabbit population? Good question. So I investigated. This is Heidi Kleinert, National Feral Rabbit Coordinator for the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions.
We are definitely seeing a boom in rabbits, and that's because we've had really great conditions with spring and summer rainfalls, and not only in spring and summer rainfalls, but consecutive years of that, which provides really great food availability for the rabbits, which triggers breeding.
Now, in her email, Marge mentioned that while she mostly sees rabbits in the early morning and late afternoon, they are around all day, sometimes early in the morning. Is this typical behaviour for rabbits?
Typically, we might see rabbits around dusk and dawn. Definitely around the dusk time, they're highly active. But if you're seeing them in the middle of the day, I would assume that you've definitely got a rabbit problem in your area and rabbit numbers are high in your area.
So let's talk about how we got here. When were rabbits introduced to Australia and why?
Yes, so rabbits were introduced in Australia in 1859. Thomas Austin bought 24 wild rabbits and he released them at Barwon Park for a shooting expedition. 7 years later, Barwon Park recorded 14,000 rabbits shot. These mammals are one of the fastest colonising animals we have in Australia, and by 1874, they reached New South Wales, and by the 1900s, they've reached the WA border. By 1920, we had a population of over 10 billion rabbits.
Sorry, you said 10 billion.
10 billion.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Which is why biological control had such a big impact in the 1950s.
Just going back to the early days of rabbits being in Australia, they spread so quickly, 14,000 shot dead after 7 years. When did it become clear that they were going to be a major problem for native wildlife and agriculture?
Very early on, because rabbits in a good season can breed every 28 days. So scientists have done an experiment where if they watched two rabbits breed, and in 18 months, they had over 184 kittens in that period of time. So if you have two rabbits, you have a problem.
So rabbits are vegetarians. How do they inflict so much damage on the environment around them?
Yeah, so rabbits really graze on high protein-rich native plants. And with their presence, rabbits will stop the regeneration or the natural regeneration of plants. So pretty much if you're out in the landscape, I'd encourage you to take a look to see if there's any natural regeneration of plants, because often you'll find that there's not, unless a community group or land care have done a planting program. So they're really suppressing the regeneration of plants. They're also impacting up to 300 threatened native plants and animal species that are listed on the EPBC list. They compete with our native animals for food and shelter, and they cause soil erosion as well.
Rabbits soon became a big issue. What were some of the ways people used to control them?
We've for a long time been controlling them through baiting with toxins, destroying their shelters, so destroying their warrens through ripping, and fumigation.
When did the idea of rabbit biocontrol first come up?
The idea actually came up quite early.
This is Dr. Maria Jenkel. She's a senior experimental scientist at the CSIRO in Canberra, and she works in rabbit biocontrol.
So there was a government reward from the New South Wales government in 1887, about £25,000 back in the day, which would be about $10 million now. And Louis Pasteur suggested to use chicken cholera to kill rabbits. And his nephew was granted the opportunity to do experiments on Rhode Island. So even back then, it was suggested to use biological agents to control pests.
Makes sense that Louis Pasteur, given pasteurization was his thing, killing bacteria, but then he's using bacteria to kill something else.
Yes.
It's quite poetic.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they did experiments. They fed rabbits with contaminated feed. They also fed a bunch of livestock just to see it has had no adverse effects to the livestock. And the rabbits died. However, they didn't spread the disease to healthy rabbits. And like the name suggests, the chicken died too. So unfortunately, that was the end of it.
Okay, so that was the late 1800s. Did anything come of this reward that was offered by the New South Wales government?
I couldn't find any information on that. There definitely were several suggestions of other organisms as well. There were some experiments, but it doesn't seem like anything came of it.
The best known rabbit biocontrol was myxomatosis, which is caused by the myxoma virus. What is myxomatosis and where did that virus come from?
Myxomatosis, or caused by myxoma virus, was first described in 1896 in Uruguay. And then following a couple of outbreaks, some investigation followed in Brazil. And it was already discussed as a potential biocontrol agent in 1919, suggested by Brazilian scientists. Its natural host is an American native lagomorph, so it's a distant relative of European rabbits we have in Australia. And it just causes a benign disease, so the rabbits in South America normally don't die. However, if you then infect European rabbits, you get lesions, you get swelling of the eyelids, you get a systematic disease in the rabbits, and they eventually succumb to the disease.
So it's a South American virus which didn't kill the local rabbits but did kill the European rabbits. How does it spread between rabbits?
Most transmission, which makes it useful as a biocontrol agent, is actually through insects. In the case of myxoma virus, it's biting insects, which makes it so successful in spreading.
Okay, so an insect like a mosquito would bite a rabbit, drink some of its blood, and then when it goes to bite another rabbit, a little bit of that virus is transferred from the mozzie into the uninfected bunny.
Yeah, exactly like that.
Yeah, right. And does it do anything to humans?
No, not at all.
And no other animals, just rabbits?
Yes. So it's very specific. There's actually, well, it's not a funny story, but an anecdotal story that when they first released myxoma virus, there was also an endemic of encephalitis in the region. And obviously the people blamed the newly released myxoma virus. So three virologists, Frank Fenner, Ian Clunius-Ross, and McFarlan Burnett, injected themselves with myxoma virus, and obviously nothing happened.
That's pretty ballsy move to inject yourself with a virus and just be like, oh, no, we have full faith that this is not going to hurt us at all in the grand tradition of Australian scientists experimenting on themselves.
They were very dedicated.
I'll say.
You don't want to unleash something you don't know the effects of. By 1950, one got pretty desperate because of the rabbit plague.
How many rabbits were there at 1950?
Estimates are about 600 million.
Wow.
And myxoma virus managed to reduce that by 90% in some areas.
And of course, rabbits started becoming resistant to the virus. How long did it take before we started seeing signs of resistance?
Yeah, actually quite fast. I think between 5 to 10 years. Could already see genetic resistance from the rabbit, but also attenuation from the virus. So the virus itself became less virulent. So it's actually a classic example of virus-to-host coevolution.
Is it sort of like how COVID is becoming less deadly to humans?
Yeah, in a way, it's the same, because it's not the virus' intention, really, to kill its host, if it depends on a living host to spread.
So in the 90s, a different virus was released to control rabbits, a Khaleesi virus, which you mentioned, called rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus. Very specific name. And I'm guessing there's a clue in that. But how does this virus kill rabbits?
Yeah, like the name suggests, the rabbits develop a hemorrhagic disease that targets the liver. And then it eventually leads to multi-organ disease and failure.
And how well did Khaleesi virus work compared to even myxo?
It worked the same way as a myxoma virus worked. It spread very quickly. It spread very effectively. It also transmits via insects. However, it's a bit of a different way. It's more like carrion feeding flies who feed on the carcass, basically, and then transport the virus mechanically. And we saw less genetic resistance from the rabbit. And we don't really saw any virus attenuation.
That's so interesting. So the Khaleesi virus doesn't require the host to be alive. In fact, it would prefer if its host was dead because that's how it spreads, whereas the myxoma virus relies on the animal staying alive so that mosquitoes can feed on it and spread it that way.
Yes, exactly. That's why the two viruses work quite differently.
That's so interesting. Okay, so to boost the rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus, there were a couple of strains released over the years, which I didn't realise. I thought it was a one-and-done situation. Can you just talk me through the various strains and when they were introduced?
So we introduced or deliberately released two strains. The first one was, well, what we now call IHDV1, which wasn't released to begin with, is it escaped quarantine.
Oh, well, that's no good.
It's no good, but it is assumed that it would have been registered and deliberately released afterwards anyway. And then in 2017, we released a new strain, a bit different, but still IHDV1, and it was supposed to work better in cooler and wet areas where we have benign Khaleesi viruses circulating. And then Nature kind of threw us a curveball. And in 2015, we detected a new virus, IHDV2, which was first detected in France in 2010. And that also had quite a knockdown effect on the population.
Do we know how that RHDV2 strain got into Australia?
No, we don't. Mm. Probably travelers. The virus is quite environmentally stable, so it has spread across the world.
Wow. Okay, so that's the dominant strain that's currently causing rabbit deaths in Australia then?
Yes, it is.
So that's all fairly recent. You know, we're talking about this strain being detected in Australia in 2015, another variant of RHDV1 released in 2017. So, you know, we're talking about the last decade here. But are rabbits now becoming resistant to this virus?
I wouldn't say they become resistant to the virus, but you get kind of a population immunity. And we also, like, especially in the coastal areas that are a bit cooler and wetter, we have a benign rabbit Khaleesi virus that provides some cross protection. So the virulent Khaleesi viruses have never worked as well in those areas than they did do in the dry and arid areas. And we still see the virus active. We still see outbreaks. It still kills rabbits. The IHDV1 strain that was released in 2017, it's still used as a potent local biocide. It's still working, but it's not as effective as it was when it first arrived or was released due to, various reasons. Based on experience, we say that every 10 to 15 years, we need a new tool.
So in terms of what's next for rabbit biocontrol, are we looking at tweaking the current Khaleesi virus, or do you look for something completely different?
We look for new or other pathogens. We're also exploring genetic biocontrol, or what is also known as gene drives, so that rabbits might breed themselves out of existence by either all offsprings are male or all female offsprings are infertile. We try to select for new variants. In the last 2 years, we were able to establish a cell culture system to select for new variants that might work better than the current ones.
That's interesting about the cell culture. So are these the rabbit liver organoids I've been reading about?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right. So that is basically just a smaller version of the rabbit liver that you can grow. The cells function like they would in a live rabbit, but you can quite easily then just infect them with viruses and just see how those viruses act in those cells without having to do it in a live rabbit, which can take time.
Yes, exactly.
And money.
Yeah, money, animal welfare, time. It's not that easy to run animal experiments. And honestly, no one wants to.
What do you see as the person who's working on, I guess, the rabbit biocontrol frontline? What's next then? What can people expect to see and when?
That's a really interesting question. And unfortunately, research takes time. The last strain that we released, that just was the end of a decade of research. So we are just starting now to try to select for new viruses. Even if the research doesn't take that long, then there's the whole registration process to fulfill all our regulatory hurdles. There's quite a lot that is expected of us beyond just providing a virus.
When you see rabbits out and about in Canberra, do you look at them and think, live it up while you can, because there's something new coming your way?
Yes. Although I know that the rabbits that I see will probably won't be around by the time we can provide something new.
Okay. All right. Well, they're offspring then. They're many generations.
Exactly.
Dr. Maria Jenkel, a senior experimental scientist in rabbit biocontrol at the CSIRO. We also heard from Heidi Kleinert, National Feral Rabbit Coordinator for the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions. Next week, Robin is back with a fresh batch of stories from his travels in the US. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher, and I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.